He had reached the part in the story where Scrooge is being spirited around by that jolly giant, the Ghost of Christmas Present. Over the course of his childhood, the Count had been read A Christmas Carol no less than 3 times. So he certainly remembered the visit Scrooge and his guide paid to the laughter-filled party at Scrooge's nephew's house, just as he remembered the visit they paid to the humble yet heartfelt celebration at the Cratchits'. But he had completely forgotten that, upon leaving the Cratchits', the second spirit had taken Scrooge out of the city of London altogether, to a bleak and deserted moor, where a family of miners was celebrating the season in their ramshackle hut at the edge of the mine. And from there to a lighthouse on a rocky outpost, where the waves thundered as the 2 craggy keepers of the beacon joined their hands in Yuletide song. And from there, further and further, the spirit carried Scrooge into the howling darkness of the rolling sea, until they alit upon the deck of a ship where every man, good or bad, had fond thoughts of home and a kinder word for his mates. Who knows? Perhaps what stirred the Count were these far-flung figures sharing in the fellowship of the season, despite their lives of hard labour in inhospitable climes. Perhaps it was the sight earlier in the evening of that modern young couple proceeding toward romance in the age-old fashion. Perhaps it was the chance meeting with Nikolai, who, despite his heritage, seemed to be finding a place for himself in the new Russia. Or perhaps it was the utterly unanticipated blessing of Nina's friendship. Whatever the cause, when the Count closed his book and turned out the light, he fell asleep with a great sense of well-being. But had the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come suddenly appeared and roused the Count to give him a glimpse of the future, he would have seen that his sense of well-being had been premature. For less than 4 years later, after another careful accounting of the twice-tolling clock's 12 chimes, Alexander Ilyich Rostov would be climbing to the roof of the Metropole Hotel in his finest jacket and gamely approaching its parapet in order to throw himself into the street below. Book 2. 1923. An actress, an apparition, an apiary. At 5 o'clock on the 21st of June, the Count stood before his closet with his hand on his plain grey blazer and hesitated. In a few minutes he would be on his way to the barber shop for his weekly visit, and then to the Shalyapin to meet Mishka, who would probably be wearing the same brown jacket he'd worn since 1913. As such, the grey blazer seemed a perfectly suitable choice of attire. That is, until one considered that it was an anniversary of sorts. For it had been 1 year to the day since the Count had last set foot outside of the Metropole Hotel. But how was one to celebrate such an anniversary? And should one? For while house arrest is a definitive infringement upon one's liberty, presumably it is also intended to be something of a humiliation. So both pride and common sense would suggest that such an anniversary might best be left unmarked. And yet, even men in the most trying of circumstances, like those lost at sea or confined to prison, will find the means to carefully account the passing of a year. Despite the fact that all the splendid modulations of the seasons and those colourful festivities that recur in the course of normal life have been replaced by a tyranny of indistinguishable days, the men in such situations will carve their 365 notches into a piece of wood or scratch them into the walls of their cell. Why do they go to such lengths to mark time, when, ostensibly, to do so should matter to them least of all? Well, for one, it provides an occasion to reflect on the inevitable progress of the world they've left behind. Ah, Alyosha must now be able to climb the tree in the yard, and Vanya must be entering the academy, and Nadia, dear Nadia, will soon be of an age to marry. But just as important, A careful accounting of days allows the isolated to note that another year of hardship has been endured, survived, bested. Whether they have found the strength to persevere through a tireless determination or some foolhardy optimism, those 365 hatch marks stand as proof of their indomitability. For after all, if attentiveness should be measured in minutes and discipline measured in hours, then indomitability must be measured in years. Or, if philosophical investigations are not to your taste, then let us simply agree that the wise man celebrates what he can. Thus, the Count donned his finest smoking jacket, custom-made in Paris from a burgundy velvet, and headed down the stairs. When the Count reached the lobby, before he could continue to the barber shop, his eyes were drawn to a willowy figure coming through the hotel's doors. But then all eyes in the lobby were drawn to her. A tall woman in her mid-twenties with arched eyebrows and auburn hair, she was indisputably striking. And as she approached the front desk, she walked with a breezy sureness, as seemingly unaware of the feathers projecting from her hat as of the bellhops dragging her luggage behind her. But what guaranteed her position as the natural centre of attention were the two borzois she had on leash. In an instant, the Count could see that they were magnificent beasts. Their coats silver, their loins lean, their every sense alert, these dogs had been raised to give chase in the cold October air with a hunting party hot on their heels. And at day's end, they were meant to sit at the feet of their master before a fire in a manor house, not adorn the hands of a willow in the lobby of a grand hotel. The injustice of this was not lost on the dogs. As their mistress addressed Arcady at the front desk, they tugged every which way, sniffing about for familiar landmarks. "Stop it!" the willow commanded in a surprisingly husky voice. Then she yanked in a manner that showed she had no more familiarity with the wolf-hounds on her leashes than she had with the birds that had feathered her hat. The Count gave the situation the shake of the head it deserved. But as he turned to go, he noticed with some amusement that a slender shadow suddenly jumped from behind a wing-back chair to the edge of one of the potted palms. It was none other than Field Marshal Kutuzov, attaining higher ground to take measure of his foes. When the dogs turned their heads in unison with their ears upright, the one-eyed cat slipped behind the trunk of the tree. Then, having satisfied himself that the dogs were securely tethered, the cat alit from the palm to the floor, and without even bothering to arch his back, opened his little jaws and hissed. With a terrific volley of barking, the dogs leapt to the extent of their leashes, tugging their mistress from the front desk as the ledger pen clattered to the floor. "Whoa!" she shouted. "Whoa!" Apparently unfamiliar with equine commands, the wolfhounds leapt again and, freeing themselves from the willow's grip, scrambled toward their prey. Kutuzov was off like a shot. Slipping under the western embankment of lobby chairs, the one-eyed cat dashed toward the front door, as if intending to escape into the street. Without a moment's hesitation, the dogs gave chase. Opting for a pincer movement, they split at the potted palms and pursued the cat on opposite sides of the chairs, in the hopes of cutting him off at the door. A lamp that blocked the path of the first hound was knocked to the floor in a shower of sparks, while a standing ashtray that blocked the second was sent head over heels, discharging a cloud of dust. But just as the dogs were closing ranks, Kutuzov, who, like his namesake, had the advantage of familiar terrain, suddenly reversed course. Cutting in front of a coffee table, he dashed under the eastern embankment of lobby chairs and headed back toward the staircase. It took only a few seconds for the borzois to recognize the cat's tactic. But if attentiveness is measured in minutes, discipline in hours, and indomitability in years, then the attaining of the upper hand on the field of battle is measured in the instant. For just as the wolfhounds registered the cat's reversal and attempted to turn, The lobby's expansive oriental carpet came to an end, and the dog's momentum sent them skidding across the marble floor into the luggage of an arriving guest. With an advantage over his adversaries of 100 feet, Kutuzov skipped up the first few steps of the staircase, paused for a moment to admire his handiwork, then disappeared around the corner. You may accuse a dog of eating without grace or of exhibiting a misplaced enthusiasm for the tossing of sticks, but you may never accuse one of giving up hope. Despite the fact that the cat had a decisive lead and knew every nook and cranny of the hotel's upper floors, once the dogs regained their footing, they charged across the lobby in full chorus with every intention of mounting the stairs. But the Hotel Metropole was not a hunting ground. It was a residence par excellence, an oasis for the worn and weary. So, with a slight curl of the tongue, the Count gave an upward-sloping whistle in G major. At the sound, the dogs broke pursuit and began restlessly circling at the foot of the stairs. The Count gave two more whistles in quick succession, and the dogs, resigning themselves to the fact that the day was lost, trotted to the Count and heeled at his feet. "Well, my boys," he said, giving them a good scratching behind the ears, "where do you hail from?"
"Hop!"
replied the dogs.
"Ah,"
said the Count. "How lovely." After smoothing her skirt and straightening her hat, the willowy one gracefully crossed the lobby to the Count, where, thanks to a pair of French heels, she met him eye to eye. At such proximity, the Count could see that she was even more beautiful than he had suspected, and haughtier too. His natural sympathies remained with the dogs.
"Thank you,"
she said, with a smile that presumed to launch Amada's.
"I am afraid that they are quite ill-bred."
"On the contrary," replied the Count, "they appear to be perfectly bred." The willow made a second effort at her smile.
"What I meant to say is that they are ill-behaved."
"Yes, perhaps ill-behaved, but that is a matter of handling, not breeding." As the willow studied the Count, he noted that the arches over her eyebrows were very much like the Moccato notation in music, that accent which instructs one to play a phrase a little more loudly. This, no doubt, accounted for the willow's preference for issuing commands and the resulting huskiness of her voice. But as the Count was coming to this conclusion, the willow was apparently coming to a conclusion of her own, for she now dispensed with any intent to charm.
"Handling does seem to have a way of eclipsing breeding," she said acerbically, "and for that very reason I should think that even some of the best-bred dogs belong on the shortest leashes."
"An understandable conclusion," replied the Count, "but I should think the best-bred dogs belong in the surest hands." 1 hour later, with his hair neatly trimmed and his chin cleanly shaved, the Count entered the Shalyapin and selected a small table in the corner at which to wait for Mishka, who was in town for the inaugural Congress of RAPP. It was only as he settled in that he realized the willowy beauty, now in a long blue dress, was sitting on the banquette directly opposite his own. She had spared the bar the spectacle of trying to manage her dogs, but in their place she had brought along a round-faced fellow with a receding hairline for whom puppy-like devotion seemed to come a little more naturally. While the Count was smiling at his own observation, he happened to meet the willow's gaze. As was only fitting, the two adults immediately acted as if they hadn't seen each other, the one by turning to her puppy, and the other by turning to the door. And as luck would have it, there was Mishka right on time, but with a brand new jacket and a well-groomed beard. The Count came out from behind the table in order to embrace his friend. Then, rather than reclaim his seat, he offered the banquette to Mishka, an action that seemed at once courteous and opportune, since it allowed the Count to turn his back on the willow.
"Well now," said the Count with a clap of the hands, "what shall it be, my friend? Champagne? Chateau d'Yquim? A dish of beluga before supper?"
but with a shake of the head, Mishka asked for a beer and explained that he could not stay for dinner after all. Naturally, the Count was disappointed by the news. After a discreet inquiry, he had learned that the evening special at the Boyarsky was roasted duck, the perfect dish for two old friends to share. And Andre had promised to set aside a particular grand cru that not only complimented the duck, but would inevitably lead to a retelling of the infamous night when the Count had become locked in the Rothschild's wine cellar with the young Baroness. But while the Count was disappointed, he could see from his old friend's fidgeting that he had his own stories to tell. So, as soon as their beers were before them, the Count asked how things were progressing at the Congress. Taking a drink, Mishka nodded that here was the topic of the hour, the very conversation that would soon be engrossing all of Russia, if not the world. "There were no hushed voices today, Sasha, no dozing or fiddling with pencils, for in every corner, from every hand, there was work being done." If offering Mishka the banquet had been gracious and opportune, it also had the added benefit of keeping him in his seat. For were he not trapped behind the table, he would already have leapt to his feet and been pacing the bar. And what was the work being done at this Congress? As best as the Count could determine, it included the drafting of declarations of intent, proclamations of allegiance, and open statements of solidarity. Indeed, the Russian Association of Proletarian Writers didn't hesitate to express their solidarity. In fact, they expressed it not only with their fellow writers, publishers and editors, but with the masons and stevedores, the welders and riveters, even the street sweepers. Why, especially the street sweepers? Those unsung few who rise at dawn and trod the empty avenues gathering up the refuse of the era. Not simply the matchbooks, candy wrappers and ticket stubs, mind you, but the newspapers, journals and pamphlets, the catechisms and hymnals, histories and memoirs, the contracts, deeds and titles, the treaties and constitutions, and all 10 commandments. Sweep on, street sweepers! Sweep until the cobblestones of Russia glitter like gold! So fevered was the first day of the Congress that dinner wasn't served until 11 o'clock. And then, at a table set for 60, they heard from Mayakovsky himself. There were no lecterns, mind you. When the plates had been served, he simply banged on the table and stood on his chair. In the interests of realism, Mishka tried to stand on the banquette, nearly knocking over his beer. He settled for a seated oration with a finger in the air. "Suddenly, I shone in all my might, and morning rang its round. Always to shine everywhere, to the very depths of the last days, to shine, and to hell with everything else. That is my motto, and the sun's." Naturally, Mayakovsky's poem prompted unrestrained applause and the smashing of glasses. But then, just as everyone had settled down and was preparing to slice into their chicken, some fellow named Zelinsky was up on his chair. "For, of course, we must hear from Zelinsky," muttered Mishka. "As if he stands shoulder to shoulder with the Mayakovsky. As if he stands shoulder to shoulder with a bottle of milk." Mishka took another sip. "You remember Zelinsky, no? The one who was a few years behind us at the university? The one who wore a monocle in 16 and a sailor's cap the following year? Well, anyway, you know the sort, Sasha. The type who must always have their hands on the wheel. At the end of dinner, say, two of you are lingering in your chairs to continue a discussion from earlier in the day. Well, there is Zelinsky, proclaiming that he knows just the place to carry on the conversation. Next thing you know, there are 10 of you being crowded around a table in some basement cafe. When you go to take a seat, he has a hand on your shoulder, steering you to this end of the table or that. And when someone calls for bread, he has a better idea. 'They have the best savatushki in Moscow,' he says. and before you know it, he's snapping his fingers in the air. Here Mishka snapped his fingers three times so emphatically that the Count had to wave off the ever-attentive Odrius, who was already halfway across the room.
"And his ideas!" Mishka continued in disdain. "On and on he goes with his declarations, as if he is in a position to enlighten anyone on matters of verse. And what does he have to say to the impressionable young student at his side? That all poets must eventually bow before the haiku. Bow before the haiku! Can you imagine?"
"For my part," contributed the Count, "I am glad that Homer wasn't born in Japan." Mishka stared at the Count for a moment, then burst out laughing.
"Yes," he said, slapping the table and wiping a tear from his eye. "Glad that Homer wasn't born in Japan. I shall have to remember to tell that one to Katerina."
Mishka smiled in apparent anticipation of telling that one to Katerina.
"Katerina?" asked the Count.
Mishka casually reached for his beer.
"Katerina Litvinov. Have I not mentioned her before? She's a talented young poet from Kiev, in her second year at the university. We sit on a committee together."
Mishka leaned back in order to drink from his glass. The Count leaned back in order to smile at his companion, as the entire picture came into focus. A new jacket and a well-groomed beard. A discussion after dinner continued from earlier in the day. And a Zelinsky who, having dragged everyone to his favourite little night spot, steers an impressionable young poet to one end of the table and a Mishka to the other. As Mishka continued with his description of the previous evening, the irony of the situation did not escape the Count, that during all those years they had lived above the cobblers, it was Mishka who had stayed put, and the Count who, having apologised that he couldn't join his friend for dinner, had returned hours later with tales of lively toasts and tete-a-tetes and impromptu outings to candlelit cafes. Did the Count take some pleasure in hearing about Mishka's late-night skirmishes? Of course he did. Particularly when he learned that at the end of the evening, as the group was about to climb into three different cabs, Mishka reminded Zelinsky that he had forgotten his hat. And when Zelinsky dashed back inside to retrieve it, Katerina from Kiev leaned from her cab to call, "Here, Mikhail Fyodorovich, why don't you ride with us?" Yes, the Count took pleasure in his old friend's romantic skirmish, but that is not to suggest that he didn't feel the sting of envy. Half an hour later, after the Count had sent Mishka off to a discussion on the future of meter, at which Katerina from Kiev would presumably be in attendance, he headed to the Boyarsky, apparently destined to dine on duck alone. But just as he was leaving, Odrius beckoned. Sliding a folded piece of paper across the bar, Odrius explained under his breath, "I was instructed to relay this to you."
"To me? From whom?"
"Miss Urbanova."
"Miss Urbanova?"
"Anna Urbanova, the movie star." Since the Count still showed no sign of understanding, the bartender explained a little more loudly, "The one who was sitting at that table across from you."
"Ah, yes. Thank you."
As Odrius returned to his work, the Count unfolded the piece of paper, which bore the following request in a willowy script. "Please allow me a second chance at a first impression in Suite 208. When the Count knocked on the door of Suite 208, it was opened by an older woman who regarded him with impatience.
"Yes?"
"I am Alexander Rostov."
"You're expected. Come in. Miss Urbanova will be a moment."
Instinctively, the Count prepared to offer the woman a witty remark about the weather, but when he stepped inside, she stepped out and closed the door, leaving him alone in the entryway. Decorated in the style of a Venetian palazzo, Suite 208 was one of the finest accommodations on the floor and looked no worse for wear now that the tireless typers of directives had finally moved to the Kremlin. With a bedroom and drawing room on either side of a grand salon, Its ceilings were painted with allegorical figures gazing down from the heavens. On an ornate side table stood two towering arrangements of flowers, one of calla lilies and the other of long-stem roses. The fact that the two arrangements matched each other in extravagance, while clashing in colour, suggested they were from competing admirers. One could only imagine what a third admirer would feel obliged to send.
"Have you right out?" called a voice from the bedroom. "Take your time," called back the Count.
At the sound of his voice, there was a light clacking of nails on the floor as the Borzois appeared from the drawing-room.
"Hello, boys,"
he said, giving them another scratch behind the ears. Having paid their respects, the dogs trotted to the windows overlooking Theatre Square and rested their forepaws on the sills in order to watch the movement of the cars below.
"Count Rostov."
Turning, the Count found the actress dressed in her third outfit of the day, black pants and an ivory blouse. With a smile of an old acquaintance and her hand extended, she approached.
"I'm so pleased you could come."
"The pleasure is mine, Miss Urbanova."
"I doubt that, but please call me Anna."
Before the Count could reply, there was a knock at the door.
"Ah," she said, "here we are."
Swinging the door open, she stepped aside to let Oleg from room service pass. When Oleg caught sight of the Count, he nearly ran his dinner cart into the competing arrangements of flowers.
"Perhaps over there by the window," suggested the actress.
"Yes, Miss Urbanova,"
said Oleg, who, having regained his composure, set a table for two, lit a candle, and backed out the door. The actress turned to the Count.
"Have you eaten? I've been in two restaurants and a bar today and haven't had a bite. I'm absolutely starving. Won't you join me?"
"Certainly."
The Count pulled back a chair for his hostess and, as he took his seat on the opposite side of the candle, the Borzois looked back from their windows. Presumably, here was a scene that neither of the dogs could have anticipated earlier that day. But having long since lost interest in the fickle course of human affairs, they dropped to the floor and trotted back to the drawing-room without a second glance. The actress watched them retire a little wistfully.
"I confess that I am not a dog-lover."
"Then why do you have them?"
"They were a gift."
"Ah, from an admirer,"
she responded with a wry smile.
"I would have settled for a necklace."
The Count returned the smile.
"Well," she said, "let's see what we've got."
Removing the silver dome from the serving plate, the actress revealed one of Emile's signature dishes, whole bass roasted with black olives, fennel, and lemon.
"Lovely," she said.
And the Count could not agree more, for by setting his oven to 450 degrees, Emile ensured that the flesh of the fish was tender, the fennel aromatic, and the lemon slices blackened and crisp.
"So, two restaurants and a bar without having a bite to eat."
Thus began the Count, with the natural intention of letting the actress recount her day while he prepared her plate. But before he could lift a finger, she had taken the knife and serving fork in hand, and as she began to relate the professional obligations that had commandeered her afternoon, she scored the fish's spine with the tip of the knife and made diagonal cuts at its head and tail. Then, slipping the serving fork between the fish's spine and its flesh, she deftly liberated the fillet. In a few succinct movements, she had served portions of the fennel and olives, and topped the fillet with a charred lemon. Handing the Count this perfectly prepared plate, she plucked the spine from the fish and served herself the second fillet with accompaniments, an operation that took no more than a minute. Then, placing the serving utensils on the platter, she turned her attention to the wine.
"Good God," thought the Count.
So engrossed had he been in watching her technique, he had neglected his own responsibilities. Leaping from his chair, he took the bottle by the neck.
"May I?"
"Thank you."
As the Count poured the wine, he noted it was a dry Montrachet, the perfect complement to Emile's Bass, and clearly the handiwork of Andre. The Count raised his glass to his hostess.
"I must say that you deboned that fish like an expert."
She laughed.
"Is that a compliment?"
"Of course it's a compliment. Well, at least it was intended as one."
"In that case, thank you. But I wouldn't make too much of it. I was raised in a fishing village on the Black Sea, so I've tied more than my share of knots and filleted more than my share of fish."
"You could do worse than dining on fish every night."
"That's true. But when you live in a fisherman's house, you tend to eat what can't be sold. So more often than not, we dined on flatfish and bream."
"The bounty of the sea.
The bottom of the sea."
And with that disarming memory, Anna Urbanova was suddenly describing how, as a girl, she would steal away from her mother at dusk and wind her way down the sloping streets of her village so that she could meet her father on the beach and help him mend his nets. And as she talked, the Count had to acknowledge once again the virtues of withholding judgment. After all, what can a first impression tell us about someone we've just met for a minute in the lobby of a hotel? For that matter, what can a first impression tell us about anyone?
Why, no more than a chord can tell us about Beethoven, or a brushstroke about Botticelli.
By their very nature, human beings are so capricious, so complex, so delightfully contradictory, that they deserve not only our consideration, but our reconsideration, and our unwavering determination to withhold our opinion until we have engaged with them in every possible setting at every possible hour. Take the simple case of Anna Urbanova's voice. In the context of the lobby, where the actress was struggling to rein in her hounds, the hoarseness of her voice had given the impression of an imperious young lady prone to shouting. Very well. But here, in Suite 208, in the company of charred lemons, French wine, and memories of the sea, her voice was revealed as that of a woman whose profession rarely allowed her the chance for repose, never mind the enjoyment of a decent meal. As the Count refilled their glasses, he was struck by a memory of his own that seemed in keeping with the conversation. "I spent a good part of my youth in the province of Nizhny Novgorod," he said, "which happens to be the world capital of the apple. In Nizhny Novgorod, there are not simply apple trees scattered about the countryside. There are forests of apple trees, forests as wild and ancient as Russia itself, in which apples grow in every colour of the rainbow, and in sizes ranging from a walnut to a cannonball."
"I take it you ate your fair share of apples."
"Oh, we'd find them tucked in our omelettes at breakfast, floating in our soups at lunch, and stuffed in our pheasants at dinner. Come Christmas, we'd eaten every single variety the woods had to offer."
The Count was about to lift his glass to toast the comprehensiveness of their apple-eating, when he waved a self-correcting finger.
"Actually, there was one apple that we did not eat."
The actress raised one of her bedeviling eyebrows.
"Which?"
"According to local lore, hidden deep within the forest was a tree with apples as black as coal, and if you could find this tree and eat of its fruit, you could start your life anew."
The Count took a generous drink of the Montrachet, pleased to have summoned this little folktale from the past.
"So would you?"
the actress asked.
"Would I what?"
"If you found that apple hidden in the forest, would you take a bite?"
The Count put his glass on the table and shook his head.
"There's certainly some allure to the idea of a fresh start. But how could I relinquish my memories of home, of my sister, of my school years?"
The Count gestured to the table.
"How could I relinquish my memory of this?"
And Anna Urbanova, having put her napkin on her plate and pushed back her chair, came round the table, took the Count by the collar, and kissed him on the mouth. Ever since reading her note in the Shalyapin bar, the Count had felt one step behind Miss Urbanova. The casual reception in her suite, the candlelit dinner for two, the deboning of the fish followed by memories of childhood. He had not anticipated any one of these developments. Certainly he had been caught off guard by the kiss, and now here she was strolling into her bedroom, unbuttoning her blouse, and letting it slip to the floor with a delicate whoosh. As a young man, the Count had prided himself on being one step ahead. The timely appearance, the apt expression, the anticipation of a need. To the Count, these had been the very hallmarks of the well-bred man. But under the circumstances, he discovered that being a step behind had merits of its own. For one, it was so much more relaxing. To be a step ahead in matters of romance requires constant vigilance. If one hopes to make a successful advance, one must be mindful of every utterance, attend to every gesture, and take note of every look. In other words, to be a step ahead in romance is exhausting. But to be a step behind? To be seduced? Why, that was a matter of leaning back in one's chair, sipping one's wine, and responding to a query with the very first thought that has popped into one's head. And yet, paradoxically, if being a step behind was more relaxing than being a step ahead, it was also more exciting. From his relaxed position, the one-step-behinder imagines that his evening with a new acquaintance will transpire like any other, with a little chit, a little chat, and a friendly good night at the door. But halfway through dinner, there is an unexpected compliment, and an accidental brushing of fingers against one's hand. There is a tender admission and a self-effacing laugh. Then suddenly, a kiss. From here, the surprises only grow in power and scope, such as when one discovers, as the blouse falls to the floor, that a back is as decorated with freckles as the skies are decorated with stars, or when, having slipped modestly under the covers, the sheets are cast aside and one finds oneself on one's back with a pair of hands pressing on one's chest and a pair of lips issuing breathless instructions. But while each one of these surprises inspires a new state of wonder, nothing can compare to the awe one experiences when, at one in the morning, a woman, rolling on her side, utters unambiguously, "As you go, be sure to draw the curtains." Suffice it to say that once the Count's clothes had been gathered, the curtains were dutifully drawn. What's more, before he had tiptoed to the door half-dressed, he took a moment to ensure that the actress's ivory blouse had been picked off the floor and hung on its hanger. After all, as the Count himself had observed just hours before, the best-bred dogs belong in the surest hands. The sound of the door clicking shut behind you. The Count wasn't sure he had ever heard it before, exactly. In tone, it was delicate and unobtrusive. And yet it had a definitive suggestion of dismissal, which was apt to put one in a philosophical frame of mind. Even if a person generally frowned upon rude and abrupt behaviour, under the circumstances he might have to admit a certain rough justice upon finding himself in an empty hallway with his shoes in his hand and his shirt untucked, as the woman he's just left falls soundly asleep. For if a man has had the good fortune to be plucked from the crowd by an impetuous beauty, shouldn't he expect to be sent on his way without ceremony? Well, maybe so. But standing in the empty corridor across from a half-eaten bowl of borscht, the Count felt less like a philosopher than a ghost. Yes, a ghost, thought the Count, as he moved silently down the hall. Like Hamlet's father roaming the ramparts of Elsinore after the midnight watch. Or like Akaki Akakievich, that forsaken spirit of Gogol's, who in the wee hours haunted the Kalinkin Bridge in search of his stolen coat. Why is it that so many ghosts prefer to travel the halls of night? Ask the living, and they will tell you that these spirits either have some unquenched desire, or an unaddressed grievance that stirs them from their sleep and sends them out into the world in search of solace. But the living are so self-centred. Of course they would judge a spirit's nocturnal wanderings as the product of earthly memories, when in fact, if these restless souls wanted to harrow the bustling avenues of noon, there is nothing to stop them from doing so. No, if they wander the halls of night, it is not from a grievance with or envy of the living. Rather, it is because they have no desire to see the living at all, any more than snakes hope to see gardeners, or foxes the hounds. They wander about at midnight because at that hour they can generally do so without being harried by the sound and fury of earthly emotions. After all those years of striving and struggling, of hoping and praying, of shouldering expectations, stomaching opinions, navigating decorum, and making conversation, what they seek, quite simply, is a little peace and quiet. At least, that is what the Count told himself as he drifted down the hall. While, as a rule, the Count always took the stairs, when he approached the second-floor landing that night, on some ghostly whim, he called for the elevator, assuming he would have it to himself. But when the door slid open, there was the one-eyed cat. "Kutuzov!" he exclaimed in surprise. Taking in every detail of the Count's appearance, the cat responded exactly as the Grand Duke had responded under similar circumstances many years before, that is, with a stern look and a disappointed silence. "Ahem," said the Count, as he stepped onto the elevator while trying to tuck in his shirt without dropping his shoes. Parting with the cat on the fifth floor, the Count trudged up the steps of the belfry in woeful acknowledgement that the celebration of his anniversary had been a fiasco. Having set out to gamely etch his mark on the wall had etched its mark on him. And as experience had taught the Count many years before, when this happens, it is best to wash one's face, brush one's teeth, and pull one's covers over one's head. But as the Count was about to open the door to his rooms, on the back of his neck he felt a breath of air that was distinctly reminiscent of a summer breeze. Turning to his left, the Count stood motionless. There it was again, coming from the other end of the floor. Intrigued, the Count walked down the hall, only to find that all the doors were tightly shut. At the hallway's end, there seemed to be nothing but a confusion of pipes and flues. But in the farthest corner, in the shadow of the largest pipe, he discovered a wall-mounted ladder that led to a hatch in the roof, which someone had left open. Putting on his shoes, the Count quietly climbed up the ladder and out into the night. The summer breeze that had beckoned the Count now wrapped him in its full embrace. Warm and forgiving, it called up feelings of summer nights from earlier in his life, from when he was 5 and 10 and 20 on the streets of St. Petersburg or the pastures of Idle Hour. Nearly overcome by the surge of old sentiments, he needed to pause a moment before continuing to the western edge of the roof. Before him lay the ancient city of Moscow, which, after waiting patiently for 200 years, was once again the seat of Russian governance. Despite the hour, the Kremlin shimmered with electric light from every window, as if its newest denizens were still too drunk with power to sleep. But if the lights of the Kremlin shimmered brightly, like all earthly lights before them, they were diminished in their beauty by the majesty of the constellations overhead. Craning his neck, the Count tried to identify the few that he had learned in his youth. Perseus, Orion, the Great Bear, each flawless and eternal. To what end, he wondered, had the Divine created the stars in heaven to fill a man with feelings of inspiration one day and insignificance the next? Lowering his gaze to the horizon, the Count looked out beyond the limits of the city, to where that ancient comfort of sailors, the morning star, burned brightest in all the firmament, and then blinked. "Good morning, Your Excellency." The Count spun about. Standing a few feet behind him was a man in his early 60s, wearing a canvas cap. When the man took a step forward, the Count recognized him as one of the handymen who battled the hotel's leaky pipes and creaky doors.
"That's Shukov, all right," he said.
"The Shukov?"
"The radio tower."
He pointed in the distance toward the comfort of sailors.
"Ah," thought the Count with a smile. "Mishka's spiraling structure of steel, broadcasting the latest news and intelligence."
The two men were silent for a moment, as if waiting for the beacon to blink again, which it reliably did.
"Well, the coffee'll be ready. You might as well come along."
The old handyman led the Count to the northeast corner of the roof, where he had established something of a camp between two chimneys. In addition to a three-legged stool, there was a small fire burning in a brazier, on which a coffee pot was steaming. The old man had chosen the spot well, for while it was out of the wind, he still had a view of the Bolshoi that was only slightly impaired by some old crates stacked at the edge of the roof.
"I don't get many visitors," the handyman said, "so I don't have a second stool."
"That's quite all right," said the Count, picking up a 2-foot plank, setting it on end, and balancing himself on its edge.
"Can I pour you a cup?"
"Thank you." As the coffee was being poured, the Count wondered whether this was the beginning or end of the old man's day. Either way, he figured a cup of coffee would hit the spot. For what is more versatile? As at home in tin as it is in Limoges, coffee can energize the industrious at dawn, calm the reflective at noon, or raise the spirits of the beleaguered in the middle of the night.
"It's perfect," said the Count.
The old man leaned forward.
"The secret is in the grinding."
He pointed to a little wooden apparatus with an iron crank.
"Not a minute before you brew."
The Count raised his eyebrows with the appreciation of the uninitiated. Yes, in the open air on a summer night, the old man's coffee was perfect. In fact, the only thing that spoiled the moment was a humming in the air, the sort that might be emitted from a faulty fuse or a radio receiver.
"Is that the tower?" the Count asked.
"Is what the tower?"
"The humming." The old man looked up in the air for a moment, then cackled.
"That'll be the boys at work."
"The boys?" The old man pointed with a thumb to the crates that compromised his view of the Bolshoi. In the pre-dawn light, the Count could just make out a whirl of activity above them.
"Are those bees?" "Indeed they are."
"What are they doing here?"
"Making honey."
"Honey?" The old man cackled again.
"Making honey is what bees does. Here."
Leaning forward, the old man held out a roof tile on which there were 2 slices of black bread slathered with honey. The Count accepted one and took a bite. The first thing that struck him was actually the black bread, for when was the last time he had even eaten it? If asked outright, he would have been embarrassed to admit. Tasting of dark rye and darker molasses, it was a perfect complement to a cup of coffee. And the honey? What an extraordinary contrast it provided. If the bread was somehow earthen, brown and brooding, the honey was sunlit, golden and gay. But there was another dimension to it, an elusive yet familiar element. A grace note hidden beneath or behind or within the sensation of sweetness.
"What is that flavour?"
the Count asked almost to himself.
"The lilacs," the old man replied.
Without turning, he pointed with his thumb back in the direction of the Alexander Gardens.
"Of course," thought the Count. "That was it precisely. How could he have missed it?"
Why, there was a time when he knew the lilacs of the Alexander Gardens better than any man in Moscow. When the trees were in season, he could spend whole afternoons in happy repose under their white and purple blossoms.
"How extraordinary,"
the Count said, with an appreciative shake of the head.
"It is and isn't," said the old man. "When the lilacs are in bloom, the bees will buzz to the Alexander Gardens and the honey will taste like the lilacs. But in a week or so, they'll be buzzing to the garden ring, and then you'll be tasting the cherry trees." "The garden ring? How far will they go?"
"Some say a bee will cross the ocean for a flower," answered the old man with a smile, "though I've never known one to do so."
The Count shook his head, took another bite, and accepted a second cup of coffee.
"As a boy, I spent a good deal of time in Nizhny Novgorod," he recalled for the second time that day. "Where the apple blossoms fall like snow," the old man said with a smile. "I was raised there myself. My father was the caretaker on the Schoenig estate."
"I know it well," exclaimed the Count. "What a beautiful part of the world."
So, as the summer sun began to rise, the fire began to die, and the bees began to circle overhead, the two men spoke of days from their childhoods, when the wagon wheels rattled in the road, and the dragonflies skimmed the grass, and the apple trees blossomed for as far as the eye could see.
Addendum. At the very moment that the Count heard the door to Suite 208 clicking shut, Anna Urbanova was, in fact, falling asleep, but she did not sleep soundly. When the actress first dismissed the Count, having rolled onto her side with a languid sigh, she watched with cool pleasure as he gathered his clothes and drew the curtains. She even took some satisfaction when he paused to pick up her blouse and hang it in the closet. But at some point during the night, this image of the Count picking up her blouse began to trouble her sleep. On the train back to St. Petersburg, she found herself muttering about it. And by the time she returned home, it positively infuriated her. In the week that followed, if she had the slightest break in her demanding schedule, the image rushed forth, and her famous alabaster cheeks grew red with rage.
"Who does he think he is, this Count Rostov? Pulling out chairs and whistling at dogs? Putting on airs and looking down noses is more like it. But by what right? Who gave him permission to pick up a blouse and hang it on its hanger? If I drop my blouse on the floor, what of it? It's my clothing, and I can treat it as I please."
Or so she would find herself reasoning to no one in particular. One night, returning from a party, the very thought of the Count's precious little gesture was so infuriating that when she undressed, she not only threw her red silk gown on the floor, she instructed her staff that it was not to be touched. Each night that followed, she dumped another outfit on the floor. Dresses and blouses of velvet and silk from London and Paris, the more expensive the better. Dumped here on the bathroom floor and there by the dustbin. In a word, wherever it suited her. After 2 weeks, her boudoir began to look like an Arabian tent with fabrics of every colour underfoot. Olga, the 60-year-old Georgian who had met the Count at the door of Suite 208 and who had faithfully served as the actress's dresser since 1920, initially eyed her mistress's behaviour with seasoned indifference. But one night, when Anna had dropped a blue backless dress on top of a white silk gown, Olga observed matter-of-factly,
"My dear, you are acting like a child. If you do not pick up your clothes, I shall have no choice but to give you a spanking."
Anna Urbanova turned as red as a jar of jam.
"Pick up my clothes?" she shouted. "You want me to pick up my clothes? Then I shall pick them up."
Gathering up 20 outfits in her arms, she marched to the open window and cast them into the street below. With the greatest satisfaction, the actress watched as they fluttered and coasted to the ground. When she wheeled about to confront her dresser in triumph, Olga coolly observed how entertained the neighbours would be by this evidence of the famous actress's petulance. Then she turned and left the room. Switching off the lights and climbing into bed, Anna sputtered like a candle.
What do I care what the neighbours will say about my petulance? What do I care what St. Petersburg will say, or all of Russia?
But at 2 in the morning, having tossed and turned, Anna Urbanova tiptoed down the grand staircase, slipped out into the street, and gathered up her garments one by one. 1924. Anonymity. Dreams of invisibility are as old as folklore. By means of some talisman or potion, or with the help of the gods themselves, the corporeal presence of the hero is rendered insubstantial, and for the duration of the spell he may wander among his fellow men unseen. The advantages of having such a power can be rattled off for you by any child of 10, whether slipping past dragons, eavesdropping on intriguers, and sneaking into treasuries, or plucking a pie from the pantry, knocking the cap off a constable, and lighting the schoolmaster's coattails on fire. Suffice it to say that 1,000 tales have been told in acknowledgement of invisibility's bounty. But the tale that has less often been told is the one in which the spell of invisibility is cast upon the unknowing hero in the form of a curse. Having lived his life in the heat of battle, at the crux of conversation, and in the 20th row with its privileged view of the ladies in the loges, that is, in the very thick of things, suddenly he finds himself invisible to friend and foe alike. And the spell that had been cast over the Count by Anna Urbanova in 1923 was of this very sort. On that fateful night, when the Count had dined with the enchantress in her suite, she presumably had the power to render him invisible on the spot. Instead, to toy with his peace of mind, she had cast her spell to manifest itself over the course of a year, bit by bit. In the weeks that followed, the Count suddenly noticed that he was disappearing from view for a few minutes at a time. He could be dining in the piazza when a couple would approach his table with a clear intention of taking it as their own, or he could be standing near the front desk when a harried guest would nearly knock him off his feet. By winter, those prone to greet him with a wave or a smile often failed to see him until he was 10 feet away. And now, a year later, when he crossed the lobby, it often took a full minute for his closest friends to notice that he was standing right in front of them. "Oh," said Vasily, returning the telephone receiver to its cradle. "Excuse me, Count Rostov, I didn't see you there. How can I be of service?" The Count gave the concierge's desk a delicate tap. "You wouldn't happen to know where Nina is?" In asking Vasily for Nina's whereabouts, the Count was not making a passing inquiry of the first chap he happened to meet, for Vasily had an uncanny awareness of where people were at any given time. "She is in the card room, I believe." "Ah," said the Count, with a knowing smile. Turning about, he walked down the hall to the card room and quietly opened the door, assuming he would find 4 middle-aged ladies exchanging cookies and profanities over tricks of whist, as an attentive spirit held her breath in a cupboard. Instead, he found the object of his search sitting at the card table alone. With 2 stacks of paper in front of her and a pencil in hand, she appeared the very model of scholastic enthusiasm. The pencil was moving so brightly it looked like an honour guard, parading across the page with its head held high, then pivoting at the margin to make the quick march back.
"Greetings, my friend."
"Hello, your countship," Nina replied without looking up from her work.
"Would you like to join me for an excursion before dinner? I was thinking of visiting the switchboard."
"I'm afraid I can't at the moment." The Count claimed the seat opposite Nina as she put a completed sheet of paper on one stack and took a fresh sheet of paper from the other. Out of habit, he picked up the deck of cards that sat on the corner of the table and shuffled it twice.
"Would you like to see a trick?"
"Some other time, perhaps." Neatening the deck, the Count replaced it on the table. Then he picked up the topmost sheet from the stack of completed papers. In carefully aligned columns, he found all of the cardinal numbers from 1,100 to 1,199. In accordance with some unknown system, 13 of the numbers had been circled in red. Needless to say,